All right, for the final panel of the day, I'm Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute. I'm delighted to be a part of this project with Tom, and I'm particularly relieved today that the House of Representatives yesterday, in its vote to repeal the Brookings Institution, failed, although they promised to bring it back again. I want to also acknowledge one other person we haven't mentioned no longer with us in not in body, but in a different way. John Tanner was our passionate advocate for transparency and redistricting and to try to do something about this process in Congress, and he's retired. And so we're going to be looking for others who can help us at least carry that forward in Washington. Just a couple of comments more generally. This is a frustrating dynamic and a frustrating process. Frustrating in part because there are so many different standards, and one of the things that's attracted me to this particular project is the humility of the, not necessarily of the people themselves, but the approach that we've taken here, which indicates that there is no real answer, tries through the open source process to bring people in, even to change the software, but also recognizes that there are many, many conflicting values here. One of the frustrations for me is that the courts have basically, and the Supreme Court especially, has almost decided to punt or refuse to recognize that there are many different values here, with a focus commendably on fairness through one person, one vote that's been taken to a monomaniacal and absurd level. Tom and I wrote an amicus brief for the Veith decision. And when you go back and look through that decision, what was behind it, realize that you now have courts that reject plans that deviate by 20 people or so out of 600,000 based on census data that is basically not worth it before the ink is dry on the papers people have moved. But that creates an opening for or an excuse for those writing plans that all they have to do is make those plans equal in population. It becomes even more absurd, frankly, when you think about it and realize that as we go through this reapportionment process, we're going to end up, and this is going to continue over the next cycle and probably the one thereafter, with gross distortions in the one person, one vote principle because of the nature of apportionment. So if you have a district that represents 300,000 people and another district that represents 1 million people, how do you square that because they come within states with the principle of one person, one vote? And the court basically ignores all of that as it focuses monomaniacally on one thing. This enables us to look beyond that one thing at least and to look at how you can work through different values and at the same time realize that if you focus on compactness, you might end up creating many more very homogeneous districts that become echo chambers and move past the issue of partisanship. But do we really want in an extended republic, and as you try to look at ways in which you can represent different kinds of people, look at different viewpoints, if all you've got in a district are people who basically believe or look at things the same way, it's going to make it harder to reach compromise. So there are a lot of different ways in which we need to look at this. And through a process that, as the previous panels have suggested, has not had many opportunities for public participation, that where in states it has been in the interests of those involved in creating this process to cloak it with as much secrecy as possible and emerge with plans where you can say, hey, it may not be perfect, but it's the best we can do. And the whole idea behind this project and behind what we see going on in many, many states is to have opportunities for very many flowers to bloom where you can say, no, it's not the best that you can do. And that might end up providing some public pressure to provide change, or in many instances, as you go through different iterations, and as Tim suggested, in a number of states where they're just not going to be able to come to an agreement and it's going to have to go to a court, the court is then going to have a lot of data and information available suggesting that there may be other ways to go. And I believe now we're now at a point where there's enough public interest and concern about the nature of this process that we may get many more flowers blooming. If you look back at attempts in the past, for example, in Ohio and California different times with referendums to try and change the nature of their process that failed because voters in the state saw it as a basically a partisan effort on one side or the other. Now you see with California, with Florida, with other states, there's a different approach that's being taken, or at least a different attitude, a sense, a groping for a better way to create balance and fairness in this process. And so we have not only the work of Mike and Micah with some of the rest of us providing at least moral support and some additional efforts, but a lot going on in individual states, some of it supported by the political actors in those states. Some of it will not be supported by those actors, but to try and open up this process this time, and we've got some opportunities to do so. And we'll discuss in some of those areas the opportunities and the challenges. We've got four terrific people to do that. I'll introduce them alphabetically, although they won't appear necessarily in that order. Cynthia Canary is the director of the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform, which was, I think you could say, the brainchild of the late, great Paul Simon, and works to promote civic participation and reform the political process. Derek Cressman is Common Cause's Regional Director of State Operations for Western States. Quentin Kidd, who Michael highlighted before, an Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Judy Ford Wason Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University, which is in Newport News, and doing a lot, including contests. I'm a great believer in contests, gets people's juices flowing. And Nancy Tate is the Executive Director of the League of Women Voters, which has been very, very active in this area for a long time. So we're going to start with Derek to provide a few minutes of remarks looking at what Common Cause has been doing in the West, Nancy, who will look more broadly at what the League has been doing, and then Quentin, and then Cindy.
Does this turn on? Looks like. Most of you probably know Common Cause is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization founded in 1970. We do a lot of work at the federal level, but we do have chapters in 35 states across the country. Some of those are just volunteer state boards. About 25 of those we have staff resources and the ability to undertake significant projects. And we're very excited about the opportunities opened up by this type of technology for a group such as ours in general for our public participation, and have three general areas where we will endeavor to use it. The first and most ambitious is to create what we call a parallel citizens commission that would actually meet as its own body and offer an alternative set of maps to what the legislature or official legal body is going to be drawing up. And those would be available for the media and the public to contrast and compare with the official maps, as well as for courts to look at down the road. And there are about 10 or 15 of our states that are very interested in this approach. I don't think we will pull it off in all of those 10 or 15 states because there are some significant challenges to doing that. The first is that even when you look beyond the legislature, where the dynamic is usually, especially the majority party, is not interested in something of that nature, and oftentimes all incumbents aren't necessarily interested in something of that nature. But even outside of the legislature, there's not agreement that an independent commission is a good thing. Common Cause very much thinks so. That's our solution to how do you identify a gerrymander is to sort of look at the intentions of the people drawing the line and to try to create a process whereby those people are as insulated from self-interest and partisan interest as possible. But that's not universally shared among, you know, even the reform community, I would say. And so that's obviously one obstacle towards setting up a parallel commission is we view it as a way that it would actually lead to a long-term reform of institutionalizing that, such as what we've been able to do in California. But that's not a shared upon goal necessarily. So challenge one. Secondly, there is not universal agreement as to what the composition of even a parallel commission should look like or the criteria that it should use. And we've touched on that a little bit earlier today as well. Thirdly, that there are some organizations that have a focus on something other than this. If you're focused on litigation, for example, and using the Voting Rights Act to achieve outcomes that you think are important and beneficial, this may just be a distraction from that process. It may not necessarily be helpful to you to have all sorts of hundreds of maps being proposed by lots of citizens if you're trying to get a court to look at one particular map that you're proposing. And likewise, there are organizations that spend most of their energy focusing on the official process and trying to work the legislature to draw a map that they think is important, and they may or may not see a parallel commission as useful towards that. They could see it as a big time suck on their efforts. So all of those things make it a difficult and lengthy process. If what you're really trying to compile is a parallel citizens commission that is, you know, widely respected among all members of the public and not seen as a partisan ploy by one side or the other or any particular interest group. And takes a lot of time to pull together something like that. So I think we will pull that off in a number of places, but certainly not in all 50 states, at least from our point of view. Secondly, this is more about what we've been talking about today, is the approach of a contest or just any general public participation where people can draw their own maps, either an entire statewide map as a proposal, or I'm particularly excited about the opportunities for people to just draw either their own map or just self-define their own community. There's a very open question that we've alluded to today about what is a community of interest, and I think one way of finding that out is asking people, what do you see as the community that you live in? And even, if we don't have an official parallel commission, having hundreds of people draw their own communities will shed some light on that question in a way that I think will be very useful. And I think Quentin can talk more about the particulars of how a contest might look in Virginia, and there'll be various permutations of that, I think, in a good number of states across the country. And then the third approach that we're interested in at Common Cause, and I should say, our primary approach to this issue is not actually drawing maps ourselves. We rarely, if ever, do that. We focus on the process by which the maps are drawn, working for the legislature to do it in a transparent way or reforming the process by which they must do, either by setting up criteria that they must follow or creating a different commission to do that. And there are two particular reforms that have been recently enacted in Florida and in California. The Rube Goldberg scheme that we were major efforts in drawing. So if you like it or not, you can kind of blame us. But having a tool such as this will be a way, I think, to both evaluate that process and encourage the public to be more involved in that process. And I think ultimately that will help us craft better and more successful reforms in the future. And so it's useful for that sake in and of itself. So I'll wrap up there and pass things on to – or Norm, you want to pass things on? Or?
Sure. Nancy.
Okay. Well, as was mentioned, I'm the executive director of the League of Women Voters of the United States. Of the United States. I can't hear myself. The League is a grassroots organization that operates –
Is that not working?
All red here. Okay. Yeah. There we go. The League is a grassroots organization with 800 leagues in all 50 states, including and also the District of Columbia and the Virgin Islands. We operate at all three levels of government. And in fact, this year we are 90 years old. We consider ourselves a citizens organization. Obviously, we do a lot of work on elections, and we do that in the broadest sense of the word. So a lot of you know us for our voter education work, debates, voters' guides, and so forth. But we spend a lot of effort on trying to reform the election system, both at the national level and at the state and local level. And we certainly consider the whole redistricting process as part of the election process and one that could stand a lot of improvement. And we are a group that feels that the way the process works now and the types of districts that are drawn does contribute to the partisan polarization we see at the national level as well as at the state levels. We do a lot of other things in addition to elections, a lot of different ways to improve our system of government. And one of our points of focus is transparency, openness in decision-making, and citizen, or even more broadly, public participation in decisions. So certainly redistricting, both from how it affects elections generally and because the process has so typically been closed, is a major area of concern for us. Many of our state leagues have worked on this area, these problems, for years. And typically, they have been working on reforming the process itself, as is common cause. Our California, Florida, Ohio, and Virginia leagues have really been active on this, particularly in the last decade. And California and Florida have finally seen some major successes in pushing through some big changes, and we'll see how those works. Our Virginia League, and our Virginia League president is here, has had some success when the Virginia governor just agreed to set up an advisory commission this week in response to a question that the league posed to him. During this last decade, the National League has become a lot more active for a lot of the reasons stated before, the egregious problems we saw earlier in the decade. And we joined with many partner groups, many of them are here today, establishing principles that we then have promoted to our state and local leagues, where it applies locally, in terms of how we think redistricting should operate in a general way and the general types of outcomes. We are not pushing a specific solution in all states, realizing that our state leagues operate in different states, different political realities, different constitutional setups. More recently, starting about 2 years ago, we turned our focus at the national level to not so much thinking about reforming the process as how could we maximize more public participation and the quality of the plans that would come in the cycle we're in now. Because, of course, most state legislatures did not reform their process. It's the same process they've always had. So how could we help our league members be more effective in bringing the public in and coming up with better quality maps? And I do want to point out, our members are all volunteers. So they are covering all the issues that you may be aware of in your own communities, but we try at the national level to help whenever we can to give them additional assistance. So, in fact, we've just begun an effort to work in depth with 9 of our state leagues, and those are in California, Florida, Georgia, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Virginia, and really provide national-level support to them to work with their state legislatures and to do public education. We try to assist many of our other leagues in other states, you know, to the extent we can, but we are focusing on these 9. So those state leagues, in most cases, are working in coalitions. They are focusing on public education, which they can do in any of a variety of ways. They put on forums. They write letters to the editor. They hold press conferences. We do feel that educating the media and bringing visibility to this is one of the most important contributions we and any other group can make, because it's something that, as we all know, is kind of fallen below the radar screen in most situations. We have been urging the leagues to take advantage of the new mapping alternative software that you've heard about. And, in fact, Professor McDonald's doing a webinar with our league leaders this afternoon. Virginia, Ohio, and Texas leagues are working on mapping contests, and you'll hear more about the Virginia one here in a moment. And many of the leagues have, in the last 6 months coming up to this period and in this period now, working directly with the state legislatures, pushing them on more transparency. They're asking for more adequate public comment periods before and after the plans have been developed, more opportunities for community groups such as the League and others to testify. In some states, there have been statewide hearings where people have gone around the state, such as Texas. We have testified in Texas. In the Virginia, it's been the same. And we have pushed for disclosure of the timelines that the legislature is going to use and the actual steps in the process. As you've heard, not every state is as forthcoming on that as Texas has been. So what we see a lot of opportunities in this cycle for greater public participation and for better maps. And that's mostly because there has been a degree more attention to this in the press, the whole Texas situation earlier in the decade. But the big successes in California and Florida were certain, and most of those took several years to evolve. So the populations in those states heard about redistricting, the issues involved, and their level of awareness is much greater. And press coverage and media understanding has been greater, and that is spilling over to a lot more states. And so we think we're in a little bit better position with the public in general. And certainly this mapping software is just a huge breakthrough that really allows not only groups like us who are based in with average citizens trying to understand things, but people who on their own can better understand how the criteria you use and the decisions you make alter the kind of plan you have. The challenges, though, are in some ways the challenges the same as they've always been, and that is this is really complicated. As you've all heard, there are a lot of variables here, and that's assuming that you can even get the public or the media past the why should I care level. And, of course, most of the public has been in the why should I care level for a really long time, maybe since Governor Jerry came up with this idea. Part of our goal is to help people understand how these decisions do impact their lives, what happens in elections, why they should care. But as I said, even for people who do care, and as we've heard in our conversation today, it's not self-evident what's a perfect plan. What is a good district? And just looking at a picture doesn't tell you that. And so it does take a level of understanding. And it takes patience on the part of groups and of individual citizens to care enough to kind of explore this and use the software and to go to hearings and so forth. But in general, we're very hopeful that maybe this round things will go a little better.
Thanks. Quint.
I'll just talk really loud. I tend to, in a 50-minute lecture, I go up and up and up, so my volume will go up. Thanks for having me this morning. First of all, I have to come to the defense of Virginia in a historical sense. Perhaps it should be called Henrymandering, because while Eldridge Gerry is famous for what he did in 1812, Patrick Henry in 1779 actually attempted to draw his political nemesis, James Madison, out of office in that year in the 5th Congressional District of Virginia. Over 200 years later, the 5th Congressional District was also the district that a democratically controlled General Assembly drew Congressman George Allen out of office in. They probably regretted doing that because he went on to give them a harder time. Virginia has a long history of partisan mandering, partisan playing in congressional districts, in state house districts, state senate districts. And there's been an effort, League of Women Voters has been very involved in it, there's been this reform effort in Virginia for a couple years, for several years, to try to get the state,
that better? Okay.
To try to get the General Assembly to pass a law to create a bipartisan commission to redistrict the state. And it's gone nowhere. They've had bills introduced into the General Assembly the last couple of sessions, and it's gone nowhere. This group had almost given up. And the way I became involved in them not was because I'm not a redistricting expert, but I do polling, and I did a survey for this group in Virginia to sort of assess public opinion about redistricting, what the public knew about it, and what they would be interested in seeing happen in Virginia, and so just began talking to people involved in the effort, and the idea of trying to do something with the university students, college and university students, since the General Assembly wasn't going to do anything, came up in a discussion. And Michael and his software came up in that discussion. And so we simply started talking about whether it would be possible to do something with college students and this redistricting software as a way simply to provide some contrast with what the General Assembly would be doing. There was no expectation at all in the early stages that this would go anywhere other than be an academic exercise and perhaps provide some form of contrast. Now is it on? Okay. Provide some form of contrast. And so we just began putting this project together. You know, if you're aware of the academic cycle, the idea for this came up in early October. The idea of getting college faculty and college students to really get excited about something that was going to cross over into their winter break and then end about the middle of their semester. I was hopeful that we would get, you know, five or six teams, and that included a team from George Mason and a team from CNU because we could strong-arm people on campuses there. We have 15 teams from 12 colleges and universities, and James Madison, University of Virginia, William & Mary had so many students interested in participating in this that they had to put two teams together on each campus. They're not getting, as far as I know, none of the teams are course-based, so they're not getting any academic credit for this. It's not a class credit. It's simply an exercise that they're really excited to participate in. I have some supporters of the Wasson Center who are really, really interested in this, really supportive of it. So I've been able to raise prize money. So the winning map for each, the winning congressional map, the winning House of Delegates map, the winning state Senate map is going to get $2,000. I'm sorry, $2,000 for the House Delegates map, $1,500 for the state Senate map, and $1,000 for the congressional map. The House of Delegates map is 100 seats. The congressional map is 11 seats. And so the incentive is probably a part of this, but there's been really widespread interest. And I think what happened, the governor had made when he was running for office, Bob McDonnell made a promise that he would appoint this commission. And he was largely silent on it for a long time, and a lot of people thought, well, he's probably not going to do it. And the thinking is that what he saw this competition and what was going on as a way to appoint a commission to work with the competition and with the group of people organizing the competition. He saw it as a way to appoint this commission and not, you know, make people upset in the House of Delegates, make people upset around the state that might not be interested in bipartisan redistricting. And so the commission that he appointed last week, he's asked us to support their work. And so they're going to hold their first a teleconference call tomorrow, and I think it'll be the first time that they will have all gotten together, at least over the phone, to organize, to figure out how they're going to go forward. But my impression is that they're going to use the public mapping software. I don't know whether they're going to produce a map, a set of maps, or whether they're going to produce a set of maps and then invite the public to participate. But they're interested in using the public mapping software. And I know just from talking to several of them, I won't name anybody, but their objective here is to do the best job they can to demonstrate that bipartisan redistricting in some form or fashion is possible and that it's not scary, and to in some ways provide some pressure on the General Assembly to let a bipartisan process happen in Virginia. So that's the way it's going to work. What we've asked teams to do is produce maps, and I'll just read the criteria really quickly. Maps that are contiguous, equal in population, in compliance with the Federal Voting Rights Act, encompassing communities of interest that are respectful of existing political subdivisions, compact, electorally competitive, and representationally fair. They're going to produce these maps, submit them, and they have to submit a narrative explaining how they've accomplished or how they've met each of the criteria that we've set out for them. Tom and Norm are the judges of the competition, so all of this is going to come to them. They're going to look at what the teams produce, and they're going to declare a first place and second place map. We've been promised that the winning maps will be able to present. The state Senate will accept the winning maps as in the form of a presentation, and I'm relatively sure that the commission will look at them as well and accept a presentation on behalf of the winning team of each map. So it's really exciting. It's generated a lot of discussion and interest about redistricting in Virginia that I don't think in October, I don't think if you had said what's going to happen, if you'd asked me what's going to happen in March with redistricting in Virginia, I would have said, well, something will come out of the General Assembly and that'll be it. I would have never guessed that there would be this kind of discussion and interest in Virginia about redistricting. And it's, you know, it's basically because these students all over the state, probably 150, 180 of them, are really making redistricting a part of this, the topic of discussion in Virginia. So, yep.
Thanks, Quentin. I will say that Tom and I are especially excited about the swimsuit part of the competition. Cindy.
I'm the director of the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform, which works on a range of, I guess I would say, small d democracy issues, and also a founding member of the Midwest Democracy Network, and that's a collaboration of Indiana, Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, I always have to count, Minnesota, and Ohio, that was formed really out of the notion that those of us in the flyover part of America often turn to one another in our neighboring states to talk about messaging, public education, and the political reality we face, and seek counsel from one another often more than we might look to California, although we'd love going to California or to Washington or so on. I was very interested in what Quentin said about whether it should be gerrymandering or Henrymandering. It made me think of another congressional district in Illinois from the 2000 map, and if you look very closely at it, you see a tiny little notch taken out, and that notch was the home of a failed congressional candidate. But I just want you to know that he got his back. He is now renting a house at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So, you know, it all works out in the end. In the Midwestern states, we are doing, and we're doing in collaboration with the League and Common Cause, many of the things that have been discussed today, from competitions to shadow commissions to educational outreach efforts. In Illinois in particular, we're doing a lot of work with high school students and mapping. A lot of the community-based work we're doing is looking at mapping at the local level, looking at that most immediate level, particularly with young people and the environment that they know, their city, their ward. We're also very excited to be working with Michael and Micah and having this ability to do mapping and have created a rather sophisticated six-state website to bring people in, to provide them with tools and with background and to create these maps. So I think that the next couple of months will be very exciting, very busy. We've all been doing a lot of preparation over the last year or so, and, you know, suddenly we're, you know, at the starting gate now, and it should be really frenetic. I wanted to just touch a couple of points, because I think the contests and all of that's been really well gone over. First of all, where we started this morning, this is an incredibly complex topic. As a public education topic, I don't think I've ever dealt with anything as complex. Give me campaign finance any day. It is just so much easier. And one of the things that we run into a lot is what I like to call the myth of Iowa. And perhaps it's a particularly Midwestern myth. But, you know, as we do community forums, as we meet with editorial boards, you invariably get, well, why can't you just put it in a computer? That's what they do. In fact, it's not what they do, but there is the myth of Iowa. And it is something that in public education, in advocacy, you really have to to challenge, to discuss. Nobody understands when you get out in the community why it's so complicated. The Gutierrez district that Tim started with this morning, that we affectionately called the earmuff district, is an example that, you know, I get brought up to me in forums again and again and again. Isn't this egregious? Isn't this the worst thing ever? And you have to say, well, it's a voting rights district. There are reasons that districts aren't pretty, but people want pretty. And so often the first thing we have to do is say, you know, let's go through some exercises to talk about why what you want from a values perspective may not be what you want from a visual perspective. The other thing that has become really clear, particularly through our work in the Midwest, in terms of transparency and participation, is that really the tools that are put out there, the expectations of how people will interact with the state, how they will be, how much their comments on mapping will be welcome, is really reflective of the political culture of each state. Even when the states have very similar statutes on the books or even similar constitutional language, the reality on the ground is really set by the tone of that state. So you will see a very different level of expectation of participation in a state like Minnesota than you will in a state like Illinois, where we don't want nobody, nobody sent, you know? And that's the way it is. I think that these tools, and particularly this mapping tool, give us the opportunity as community groups to model what states should be doing. We have been very active at the state capitol in Illinois, advocating legislatively for more transparency, for openness, for participation, for, I never thought I would say this, for what Texas is doing. Yeah. And have really met incredible resistance. And really what we will be doing is saying, if you won't do it, state, we're going to show you how to do this. And this is not dissimilar to what we did a decade or so ago when we started putting campaign finance data online before the state did. So this is again, a practice that we are familiar with, and hopefully we will sort of shame the state into being more responsive. Just very briefly, we have been working legislatively. I think somebody mentioned at the beginning of this morning that Illinois had just, you know, sort of legislatively passed some criteria, and we have. Our mapping process is dictated by our Constitution, which really only mentions contiguous and compact districts. A piece of legislation was just passed in our lame duck session that puts forward some rather good voting rights provisions. And then, so there's one section on voting rights that was really pretty good, and then there's another section that is titled the Transparency and Public Participation section. And if it is transparency and public participation, I really need a new line of work. It is probably the most ridiculous transparency provision I've ever seen. It essentially says that they will have four public hearings to discuss the current map, the 2000 map. We've already discussed the 2000 map. We're ready to move on. But it has been very interesting, again, from a coalition-building point of view. One of the things that I'm seeing in all of our Midwestern states, and I think we're seeing around the country, is new coalitions coming together around redistricting. So traditionally, you've seen sort of the civil rights community work and the government reform community work and kind of work on different roads. Transparency and participation has been really the bridge that has brought these communities together. And in a very conscious way, we are working together based on these underlying principles that the map must be transparent. We need to know how these decisions are made, what the criteria is for drawing these lines, and that there should be opportunities for participation. So it really, I think, marks kind of a new approach to government reform kind of at the community level that I think is very positive and productive. And I think that one of the things that we will see in the next 8 months when we're all incredibly busy is much more robust and diverse coalitions, literally hundreds of organizations in the states coming together to create maps, to critique maps, and to talk about this process. So thanks.
Thanks, Cindy. We don't have a lot of time. I'm just going to ask a question or two before we open up to the audience as a whole. And I guess the question I would ask to start with is, as you look across the range of states, which states do you see as being most receptive and least receptive to an open and transparent process or getting input in different ways? And is it governed by the culture of the state? Is it a contrast between a Minnesota and an Illinois? Is it governed by whether the state has a party that has a hammerlock on the process and has no interest in opening things up? Is it affected by whether the margins in the legislature are extremely close, where there are going to be some states where it's a bipartisan process of incumbent protection as opposed to one party trying to leverage it? Does it have a relationship to the nature of the media in the state and how much they're willing to push on these things? Maybe we'll start with Derek. Yeah.
Great question. I think to generalize, I would say that states where one party controls the governor and both houses of the legislature will be less welcoming of a participation process and more inclined to pass a partisan gerrymander to the advantage of that dominant party. And then you'll have strong interest by the minority party to thwart that and interest in public participation to raise awareness about that. And then in places where there is divided control, one chamber or another or a different governor, it could go either direction. Some cases you see a bipartisan deal to protect all incumbents, and we're just going to keep everybody in office and we'll draw seats that way. But in other cases, I think that can lead to a more cooperative environment and say, well, let's set up a fair process. Let's have a lot of public participation, and let's get a map that gets drawn that doesn't get litigated forever that we can all live by. So I would say those are the main parameters to look for. Without going into specifics about individual states, which other people might want to do.
Yeah, I think absolutely in addition to the culture, certainly the partisan balance. The other thing I would suggest is not just the partisan balance, but really the strength of legislative leadership or parties within a state. You know, where power is very concentrated, processes can be very secretive.
Well, I can't really improve on those answers. I think, again, from another point of view, judging the outcome, sometimes you might just be looking at what's the lesser of the evils in terms of outcome. I mean, as one of the earlier points brought up, they might get along better. They might be protecting their own incumbents. There may not be any competitiveness, but they have gotten it through quickly. They were courteous to each other, and they didn't go to court. And so that was okay from that point of view, but they weren't that interested in listening to anybody else. So, you know, in addition to those sort of basic criteria, they can probably actually play out so something is better or worse depending on what any of us are looking at, what we might hope for in the process.
You know, I can't obviously speak across the state, but I can say that in Virginia, I don't think Virginia has a culture of openness and encourages participation. It just that isn't
the political culture of Virginia. But I think what's happened in Virginia in the last decade in particular is a realization that public policymaking is really in trouble, that the parties have deadlocked and they can't solve some really big problems, transportation, for example. And so I think what came out of that is a reform movement or a group of people who said, look, we've got to deal with this in a fundamental way, and the real fundamental way seems to be that you know, the House of Delegates is locked, controlled by Republicans, and the state Senate is controlled by Democrats, and the parties sort of trade off the governorship. But there's sort of a deadlock in who controls the chambers, and unless we make that process more competitive, public policymaking is going to continue to be crippled. So I think in the case of Virginia, it came out of a frustration on the part of reform movements and people in the General Assembly being able to solve some fundamental public policy problems.
Terrific. Thanks. We'll open up to the audience as a whole, and in the spirit of transparency, please identify yourselves.
Alan, AFIO, Republican from the state of Florida, known for its political fairness. We have a complete change in Republican leadership in the state. Some of the old boys are going to jail. One is already in jail. And we hope it'll be a little better. We wound up at the end of this infanticide with an accidental senator named Marco Rubio and a governor, sitting governor, who was thrown out of the Republican Party. So some changes have definitely been made. My question to you is, when you have a group of minority party members, and the Republican Party is the minority by at least 3-2, that is to say there are 3 Democratic registered voters for every 2 Republican, would seem that the Democratic Party would have a meaningful opposition, but they do not. Now we have an embarrassment of riches. We've just been given 2 more seats in Congress. How in the world we're going to manage to make those Republican seats is a real mystery, since there are not many Republican voters left who aren't already crammed into the states to support the current Republican sitting members. Question, how can we do this?
And I guess a part of that question is, given the changes in Florida, what impact will this have? And I think also implicit in your question is another element of this, which is something that we talked about a little bit earlier, that there are real limits to how much you can leverage partisan edges, because if you start to move in the direction of tilting one seat, you can jeopardize others and certainly cause harsh feelings among some of the members of your own party who don't want to lose those precious children who voted for them in the past.
Well, the first thing I would say is Michael talked earlier about how do you measure the partisanship of a state and a district, and I'm not sure that just looking at party registration, particularly in the South, is the best metric for that. So you may be right about the 3-2 edge in registrations, but I think you ought to also need to look at things like how do Floridans vote in statewide elections for governor, for president, for U.S. Senate. And there I would say it's fairly close. Certainly in presidential politics, we all know Florida is very much a highly contested swing state. So if you're thinking about the ideology of the voters as opposed to their party registrations, my opinion is it's pretty closely divided. But then certainly if you look at the state legislature and the congressional delegation, it is not very closely divided. And it has been intentionally gerrymandered to very much favor one particular party. So how do we get around that? The reform idea there that the League and Common Cause supported and that will be in effect for this new cycle is to place some criteria upon the legislature when they draw this new set of lines that says they cannot draw lines to intentionally favor any particular party or any particular candidate or incumbent or office holder. Now, I think then the real rub will be how do we enforce that, and how will the legislature come up with a mechanism of, in effect, doing that without in name doing that. And hence the importance then of public participation in watching that process to see if they are abiding by both the letter and the spirit of that new reform law, which passed overwhelmingly among voters on both the Democratic and Republican side of the aisle. So Florida will be a very interesting experiment to watch for the reasons that you cited. In some ways, it is a microcosm of what's going on in the country in terms of real partisanship division and also the emergence of a strong center and people like Crist and whatnot. So I don't know that I fully answered your question, but teased out some of the other complexities and what we need to look for.
And let me just say that this really does underscore the value of this project because presumably some of these plans are going to get challenged in the courts. And if you have a powerful set of additional plans that show how you can meet the criteria now that voters in Florida have overwhelmingly suggested and what the legislature has done departs from them dramatically, it's got to have an impact there. Yes.
A question mostly for you, Norm.
And identify yourself.
Chris Farrell. Yeah. At the federal level, I'd spoken to Tanner's office when he had proposed it. I knew there was a successor who would have offered his federal legislation, but that person was not reelected. Is there perhaps a kind of the perfect storm created in the congressional atmosphere for shame to come to the Congress for it? Or is it an institution that knows no shame?
Well, we saw an interesting dynamic yesterday that suggested that at least there's some capacity for shame where the debate was a radically different one than occurred when the Affordable Care Act was debated last year. So events can happen in the country that at least temporarily can, and you have to say most likely temporarily. But I do think our experience in fighting for different kinds of reforms over many decades is you've got to start with passionate champions who make it priorities and then push and push and push and then try to develop allies and figure out a way to use their positions inside to gain some public attention outside. That's the case with campaign finance reform. It's been the case in other areas as well. And so clearly the departure of Tanner means that other people have to step up into that fray. One who I think has an interest in it is Earl Blumenauer of Oregon. You would hope you would also find some Republicans in Congress who would be uneasy about some elements of this process. But frankly, it's getting harder to find champions across any areas of reform. We're losing some of them to elections, to retirements, and others who just decided that it's they're not interested in it anymore.
I'd like to have a comment from anybody.
And you are?
Royce Crocker from the Congressional Research Service.
Yeah.
It occurs to me that the whole process of political participation in redistricting, there are perhaps some unintended consequences. One of which, it seems to me, if you look at the history of redistricting, the process has gone more and more to litigation on a regular basis, with the involvement of more people or more groups involved in making maps, creating this kind of alternatives. So it occurs to me that you may have more litigation as a result of that. That's one point. As a second point related to that, with the litigation you have and with the time span that you currently have for these processes to occur, you're running up against a deadline which ends up having the courts become involved in this process and the courts drawing the maps. So that you, in essence, the unintended consequence is that you don't have political participation per se. You have the courts rather than at least the legislature, which is supposedly representative, is supposed to be involved in it, but you have the courts who are not elected who are involved in it. I'd like to have a comment about that kind of unintended consequence for the whole idea of political participation in the redistricting.
Okay, well, I'll see who wants to answer that, but I would offer one caveat. As these go to state courts, many, if not most of them, are elected, and that has an impact.
Well, I'm being congressional research, yes. So I was thinking about Congress.
Well, that's a hard question to answer. Certainly, we wouldn't want to see more cases going to court. I mean, maybe one hopeful situation in particularly, and we could perhaps California will be a good example, where you have set up an independent commission and taken out some of the other variables. I think the hope is that they will reconcile more of the different points of view and come, I think this is, will be the hope, we'll see if it happens, more of a plan that once it's released, having had more input, embedded more other plans and decided not to use them, that maybe that would decrease the number of people or groups who would feel like filing suit afterwards. I think you raise a good point. I'm not sure that in all cases it is an unintended consequence that that some of these things go to court. But clearly, and maybe the public pressure, maybe that's another way public participation could help, that to sort of convince the legislators when they're making those decisions that a very bad consequence would be to come up with a plan that doesn't meet the requirements of the Voting Rights Act or some of these other situations, so that would go to court, that the public would be very unhappy with them and that they ought to work out some of those issues and try to come up with a more compromised plan at the beginning. Certainly, you know, we want, from our point of view, we want citizens, voters, to know who their the people running from office are and not have the lines change, which often happens when the things go back and forth through litigation. You start with one plan and the next year you have another, the court comes up with a different plan and the candidates and actually change. And that's, I would say, not very good for democracy as a whole because the public tends to lose interest. They get confused and they don't care. So I'm hoping that the possibility you throw out will not come to be, but I'm not sure that it won't.
Yeah, I would just chime in, and it's a great question, but I would say in some cases, for some people, that is an intended consequence. It's not unintentional, and I'm not convinced it's always a bad thing. Living in California, we had courts draw our district lines after the 80s and 90s because there were political disputes that led to gridlock and challenges. And just if you look objectively at the maps that came out of those processes as opposed to the 2000 maps, which were a bipartisan gerrymander behind closed lines, the earlier set of lines, we saw more women elected to office. We saw better diversity of the state's ethnic groups. We saw more seats that were in play and competitive in any election as opposed to the bipartisan gerrymander. So there is a real disagreement and value underlying your question as to whether or not it is good to have districts drawn by legislatures who are elected and theoretically accountable to voters for the outcomes of those districts, or it is better to have somebody more removed, a judge. Some of the reform proposals that have percolated out there have been retired judges. In California, you know, we came up with this commission that is not legislators but not judges but somebody else. And my viewpoint is that the accountability is pretty weak. If somebody draws their own district to insulate themselves from meaningful challenge and then you say, well, that's okay because they're elected in lines that they drew, I've yet to see anybody who's been unelected for a vote that they made on a, you know, wonky issue like drawing political maps. So I'm not sure that premise of accountability works when legislatures draw them.
Just one comment on this, too. You know, we do have to focus a little bit. I think we should be focusing on what Justice Kennedy said in the Veith decision, which is basically, geez, we can't come up with any standards, so we're just going to fall back on one person, one vote, Voting Rights Act, and that's pretty much it. If this mapping software works well, we're going to be able to find in states other standards and look at maps that maximize individual standards or that create different balances in those standards. And it may be possible as we go along to end up making a case to the court that there are other ways of doing this. And maybe it's you look at a set of standards other than maximizing partisan gain and see if plans meet any of those standards or create any kind of a balance where you have other plans out there that do, that will give other justices a bit more traction in trying to make a case and maybe change the Supreme Court. At the back, and then we'll take two more here, and then we'll be done.
Thank you. Bob Benenson from Congressional Quarterly. It seems that there are two real hurdles that you face, and maybe the second one is higher than the first. The first is getting legislators and the state political establishment to allow for significant public input. The second is where you get public input, getting the legislators to actually seriously consider what's provided through public input and not just have it as window dressing to show that they're being transparent and open. What's your degree of confidence that legislatures and the redistricting authorities will actually take the publicly drawn maps and put them into the mix for what might get enacted?
I think one answer to that relates back to the earlier question. And, you know, if some of these alternative maps are drawn in a way that merit consideration by the courts, they will also merit more consideration from the legislature. So the more that, you know, as Mike and Micah said, they're using data that is apples to apples. And, you know, we have an ability to say, well, no, in fact, you can still draw a district that is compact, contiguous, and meets the Voting Rights Act, but doesn't look like this. It really forces the hand of the legislature to have a dialogue.
I agree with that. I really think this mapping software is really changing the game. In addition to the judicial aspect, the public embarrassment potential of coming up with something that when college students or somebody else comes up with some maps that meet the same criteria and they don't look as bizarre, it really makes the legislators look bad. And so you have that prompt to hopefully move them in the right direction.
And it will require a media willing to shed light on this.
Jim Snyder from iSolon. The question is, should the courts play a more important role in enhancing public participation? We don't normally think of the courts as playing an important role in public participation. But what I have in mind is the courts feel very uncomfortable when there's a political pro-incumbent gerrymander ruling for the process issues that you've raised. And what I'm suggesting is what we need is some type of public participation process standard. Specifically, what I've argued is we need an option to create a redistricting jury. So when it gets thrown into the court and the courts feel uncomfortable, the judge making a direct decision, the judge can convene a jury, which is a form of public participation, a large jury to choose among the plans. This is another vehicle for bringing the public into the process. There are other ways the courts could go out and solicit public participation. This is one vehicle. I haven't seen this as part of the redistricting reform debate, but be curious. A public participation process standard to deal with the dilemmas created by Davis and Brandemeier and political thinking type of issues that the courts are so sensitive about.
Well, I think that's a commendable idea. I mean, in some ways, presumably, the independent commissions were supposed to be high-end versions of this. But what this software does is to open up other possibilities that could make other groups, juries, panels of different sorts with citizens, or simply having maps that have been done by, in effect, citizen juries of different sorts, and maybe even a jury to adjudicate among the maps done by public groups. I mean, I think this opens up now possibilities that just never existed before because you've got the data available and the tools to use them.
This is just elaborating on these things just said here and in answer to the gentleman from Congressional Research Service. It may seem like there's more likelihood if you've got more players and more conflicting interests and more resources that can end up in court. But a major purpose of public participation has been to cut down on things ending up in court. And historically, it's been very, very effective. And the dynamic is sort of that people who might bring, who might want to go to court, if the court looks at them and says, there was a transparent, a participatory process that you could have, you know, been a part of, why weren't you a part of it? Or why are you unsatisfied with what came out of it? The courts have an inclination to, you know, to defer to what came out of a process that's considered legitimate like that. And if people are unlikely to succeed in court, they have less reason to go in the first place. And so, you know, something like this has really got a wonderful prospect of cutting down on the role of courts in, you know, especially in light of the court's, you know, preference not to evaluate the criteria. It's already going to increase that dynamic of courts wanting to say, look, there's a legitimate, participatory, transparent process. You know, we don't want to get in there and overrule it.
We have one more question that we'll take at the far back. There's another one here. We can do them quickly, and then we'll wrap up.
My name is Jamie Montgomery Baker. I flew here from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to learn about this. I work for the League of Young Voters Education Fund. And I just had two clarifying questions. I heard two terms kind of thrown around today. I didn't know really the context in which it was used. And the first one is communities of interest. What does that mean as it's been used in the meeting here today? And then the other one is compact. I've been hearing that a lot. So what does that mean versus whatever its opposite is?
I can tell you how we've described communities of interest and compactness in our in the rules for our competition. Communities of interest that are respectful of existing political subdivisions, and this is our description, counties, cities, and other political subdivisions give Virginians a sense of place and shared interest. So for the purpose of this competition, teams should seek to draw maps that minimize the division of counties and cities between districts as much as possible. It isn't a strict restriction on it, but we're just asking teams to be mindful of the fact that, you know, if you divide Manassas into three different districts, it probably makes it more difficult for Manassas than it does helps Manassas. There's a counter argument to that, I realize. Compactness, is that your other one? We define it as, I'm just going to read, compactness is sometimes referred to as the look of a district, and it assures that oddly shaped districts are minimized. The geography of Virginia's state boundary is complex. Nevertheless, teams should attempt to produce districts that looked as compact as possible. So that's the way we describe them.
Just on the communities of interest point, also, I mean, the definition varies in the context, but it is also often used to talk about minority populations that are not of a significant enough of a size to be a voting rights district. An example in my state is Chinatown. They don't have enough residents to command a district, but currently they are divided into four districts. So we have talked about, you know, recognizing Chinatown as a community of interest that should be in one district.
Good point. And yes.
Hi, Andrew Klein, Total Family Care Coalition. I have a question with regard to getting the message out to the general public. Are you going to be using multimedia as a platform and the use of blogging so that those that are decision makers can have staff members review the blog, so when it comes to the, you know, time of choosing whichever map, you have the voice of the people? And with regard to YouTube, let's say, or Facebook, how do we go about educating the general public with regards to the Fair Voting Act in layman terms?
Well, I would say this software, this website for the software has the capacity, and I think the demo showed it, to be able to get comments up, to do blogs. I think one of the things we ought to think about is ways of even linking to, say, YouTube, where you could put the demo, do a demo and a little video, or even have people go and describe the maps that they've drawn and why they've drawn them that way that may expand. But certainly, the idea of this is multimedia, very much so. But we need, I think, also to have a thousand flowers bloom in terms of ways to leverage this out to broader publics. That's one of the reasons why having competition or contests adds to that.
For our competition, we have a website, and all the students are just coming back from their 5 or 6 week winter break, where they worked really hard to earn money to pay tuition, and so they're going to be. We have Facebook pages, and that'll be coming up soon, linked to that web page. So that what we're going to do is, rather than us, the organizers, creating the social networking, we're going to actually turn it over to the student team members to do it, and we're going to ask them to do blogging and do YouTube posting, to actually do it themselves, actually take ownership of the competition and take ownership of the networking and spreading the information, rather than us sort of doing it and centralizing it. I mean, there are probably 8 different social network opportunities out there this morning that I've never heard of, and so, but they know about them all, and so they'll do it all.
Okay, I want to thank everybody on this panel and on the other panels, and all of you for coming today, and Brookings for hosting this conference. Thanks very much.